KLYT Broadcast Studio. This is ABQ Connect.
Thanks for tuning in for ABQ Connect. I always appreciate having you be a part of the broadcast. And to find out more about past shows, we encourage you to go to our website at abqconnect.online. In studio with us, Ray Mondragon, as well as Michael Ord. Ray, of course, with the Creation Science Fellowship of New Mexico, and Ray introducing me to Michael Ord for today's conversation. Gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, it's always fun for me.
And Michael joining us via phone. Michael, where are we catching up to you today?
I live in Bozeman, Montana.
Oh, well, now I'm jealous. I did get out fishing in here in New Mexico this last week, but yeah, I wouldn't mind getting in some of the streams and lakes up in Montana. What beautiful country! But we appreciate your time, and I want to start with Ray. Ray, if you'll kind of give us the introduction to our conversation today, kind of based on a lot of the conversations that you and I have had
already.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And actually, I mentioned where people can go and find, you know, they can do a search for Ray Mondragon at abqconnect.online, but they can also go to forhisglorynm.com, which is your website where you've posted our conversations as well, and I imagine this one will be there shortly.
Yeah, it'll be on the website once we get it recorded.
So the introduction today, Ray?
Well, I just wanted to remind your listeners that throughout the series that we've been doing on science and Scripture, that I've been emphasizing the authority of Scripture as the basis for all discussion. In other words, you start with Scripture, and then if you're a scientist, you do research. If you're a historian, then you do history. But I think the Bible gives us that foundation. So that's what we've emphasized in our look at the different areas of science, primarily creation science. So the authority is the Word, not science. That's the secular idea, that we look to science for answers to issues of knowledge, but we go to the Scriptures first. So we believe in the inspiration, the full inspiration and inerrancy of Scripture. So we stress that. And the reason I mention this is because Michael Ord is an example of one of the scientists that I've referred to before that takes this approach. In other words, before he does any research, he sees what the Bible has to say about the area of research. And that gives him the framework and the foundation to do good science. So he would be an example of one that we've mentioned several that approach.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said good science.
Yes.
Because, you know, at the start here, we're talking about, and we do go to the Scripture, not science, but there is, I mean, God created, and you and I have talked about that, all kinds of various sciences.
Mm-hmm. All of them.
And I don't know how much we'll touch on this today, but he's even changed how some of that works.
Well, he's changed the natural realm, and we've emphasized at least at the fall of man and also at the Genesis flood. So you have to take that into account.
Yeah.
And the secular scientist does not. In other words, he believes in uniformitarianism, and we had a whole session on it, how it is not an adequate assumption.
And with that introduction, although we've already introduced Michael Ord, I'll let you do the formal introduction and bring people up to speed who may not be as aware of Michael and his credentials.
Well, he's done research for more than 30 years in the area primarily of atmospheric science, where he has an MS degree from the University of Washington. And he's retired from the U.S. National Weather Service after 30 years of service there. And actually, he's done over 50 years of creation science research in primarily earth sciences. And we would consider him an expert in things like the ice age, things related to the aftermath of the universal flood that we've discussed. And he's going to talk a little bit about that today. So he's an expert in that area. He's an author and co-author of several books and several articles, and within the creation science community, very well known and obviously respected. And he's also been involved with the Creation Research Society as a researcher, and he's published there. So basically, he's an authority in the areas that we're going to discuss today. So it's a privilege to have him. And we desire that your audience take into account the things that we'll be discussing here. From the personal aspect, he's been married for 56 years, 4 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. And a prayer item that your audience might even consider is he's recently lost a grandchild, which that's kind of a sad thing.
Yeah, so we'd encourage our listeners.
He'd never recover from that.
No, so. And to lift up his family, Michael, you and your family in prayer. I don't know what else to say. It's just unnatural, and I'm sorry to hear that.
So we want to welcome you, Michael, and look forward to what you have to say.
Oh, you're welcome.
Any other things you'd like to mention in terms of your background that might be related to what we will discuss here? You might comment on your book. You've got a book out that you might give a little promo of it.
Okay. Actually got a 3 books that would refer to the subjects you're referring to. I have a technical monograph on ice cores put out about 20 years ago, but just this year I published a layman friendly version of ice cores with more information, including how do we explain all that ice in Greenland and Antarctica in the book The Frozen Paradox, Ice Cores versus Deep Time, what ice cores reveal about Earth's history. You can get that from Creation Ministries International. And another one I finished several years ago is called The Deep Time Deception, examining the case for millions of years. In there, I'll discuss carbon-14.
Yeah, and today we're going to discuss some of those areas, particularly ice cores. So you're going to give a little bit of what you've got in your book there.
And yes. And actually, Ray, as you mentioned books, I want to bring to a reminding people the book that you and I talked about last time you were here, your latest book, Science is God Shouting, the Biblical Foundation for Science. Information on that at truegracebooks.com. Gentlemen, with that brief introduction, we'll take a quick break and come back and jump into Michael, if you will, some of the information and evidence you have based on your study of ice cores. Can you stay with us?
Yes.
All right. We'll be back right after this on ABQ Connect.
On KLYT, this is ABQ Connect.
Thanks for joining us on ABQ Connect. Our guest today, Ray Mondragon, a regular on ABQ Connect from the Creation Science Fellowship of New Mexico, by the way, who meet the third Tuesday of each month at Moon and Central at Faith Bible Church. You can go to csfnm.org for more details on that. But I want to jump right back into our conversation. Michael, we mentioned one of your books on the topic we're covering today, The Frozen Paradox, Ice Cores versus Deep Time, What Ice Cores Reveal About Earth's History. And let's jump right in and with a look at evidence of a young Earth and universe and how ice cores help us see that.
In fact, if you would, to kind of get the audience up to speed here, if you can discuss how the old Earth camp, how they use ice cores to support their viewpoint, and then we'll contrast that how we as young Earthers not only answer that, but how we see actually evidence for a young Earth. So if you can begin by discussing the old Earth use of ice cores.
Okay. Like a lot of things you see in Earth science, you see processes or observations that appear to take a long period of time if we assume today's present rates. And that's uniformitarianism. And that's all they have to go on, present processes extrapolated over millions of years. And so ice cores are just one of those areas. It's probably the one I've delved in most in the post-flood period, having to do with the Ice Age. They say that the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets have been around for millions of years. Antarctica, they used to believe it formed during what's called their Pleistocene period, which is essentially our ice age period, but we only take the later part of the Pleistocene as the real ice age. But they used to say, oh, the Antarctic ice sheet was there about 3 million years ago. But because of some what they think are ice rafted debris off the coast of Antarctica that they date as Oligocene, about 30 million years, they suddenly overnight, the Antarctic ice sheet became 10 times as old. So they think that's been about the same, developed about 30, 35 million years ago, built up to the same height we see today at 15 million years ago, and has generally been more or less in steady state. Greenland is more unsure. They think that's been the same height for at least several million years. Some say maybe 30 million years, but I think consensus would say 2 to 3 million years. So they believe that ice has been there that much. And so as you pile a layer of snow on it each year, and at the Greenland ice sheet, they show nice seasonal cycles and various variables. Each year, the snow presses down and further down. And the fact that they believe it's been in equilibrium, the same height, more or less, for millions of years, those annual layers might start off as 30 centimeters thick in ice equivalent at the top. But by the time you get to the bottom, as you press down each layer from the layers added, it thins those annual layers and stretches them out sideways because ice is kind of like a plastic.
So by the time you smashes them down.
Yes, smashes them down and then spreads them out sideways and they end up going into the ocean. And then by the time you get to the bottom, they're about as thin as a dime. Those supposed annual layers, that's what they assume and that's what they use from uniformitarianism. And that's how they go about dating it and what to look for and analyze it. Based on that, it's hard to believe how uniformitarianism is like concrete in their heads, the concept. And no matter what, if they get contradictions, it doesn't matter. It's always fit into uniformitarianism. And that's the problem they have, because there's a whole different way of looking at the ice sheets, as I will discuss next.
Okay.
Before you get into that, you might explain more of the weaknesses besides uniformitarianism, other weaknesses of the viewpoint. Obviously, the main one would be the uniformitarian assumption that they make. And since no one was there, it's an assumption.
Yeah, and really, as we learned on earlier conversations, you and I had, Ray, in more areas than one, mm-hmm. When it comes to uniformitarianism.
So yes. Any other weaknesses with that old Earth viewpoint?
Oh, yeah. Well, they believe each ice age, they now believe, they went from one ice age in the middle 1800s to four, and that lasted 60 years, and then suddenly they jumped a number of ice ages all the way up to about 50 now. And it's not based on the continents, because every ice sheet supposedly erases the previous ice sheets. Because you see only evidence of one, mainly most areas of the continents. They get it from deep sea cores. where they send a core down, they bring up the mud, and it oscillates in certain variables. And when it oscillates one way over above the average, it's glacial. If it oscillates the other way, it's interglacial. So based on that, they have 50 of them, and the last million years they've oscillated, they believe, every 100,000 years because they assume the Milankovitch mechanism of the Ice Age, which is slight changes in the Earth's orbitals of geometry that if you extrapolate them backwards, they have certain oscillations, like the tilt cycle oscillates between 22.5 and 24.5 degrees over a period of 41,000 years. And then you got the centricity cycle. So Earth goes around the sun. It goes from a circle to a slightly flattened ellipse. And the cycle there is every 100,000 years it repeats. So they think that that is what causes the ice ages. The meteorologists have told them, since this is an old theory, that the changes in the solar radiation are too weak for an ice age. And so, but that's what they go on. They love cycles, by the way, and it's the popular one. Now, getting to the Greenland ice sheet, one of their major problems is you'd think there would be, if the ice sheet's been there several million years, you should see evidence of these ice ages or glacial times every 100,000 years. But we can tell where the glacial ice is and the inner and the post-glacial ice by what's called the oxygen isotope ratio. Yeah, it's pretty easy to tell. And so on the Greenland, top of the Greenland ice sheet, about half the ice is from the ice age, and the top half is from after the ice age. But it only shows one ice age. The Greenland ice sheet only shows one ice age, which is a problem. And of course, they could say, well, as layers get thinner and thinner, it just they disappear. Well, that's probably a decent explanation, but well, you should see some evidence there. At one time, they thought they had it by analyzing the bottom 100 meters. They stretched that out for about 200,000 years, and thought they saw a couple ice ages, but that all turned out to be deformation at the bottom of the ice, because as the ice moves, it the bottom layers deform, and so they tend to repeat, and they get confused. And they took that as evidence of ice ages, but that's all gone. It only shows one ice age. Now, the Antarctic ice sheet's different. The west, it's divided into two ice sheets, actually, the West Antarctic ice sheet and the East Antarctic ice sheet, separated by the Trans-Antarctic Mountains that go up over 4,000 meters. Now, the West Antarctic ice sheet is smaller, and they've drilled two deep cores, one just recently, and one about 1967 for the Byrd core. Those cores, not only, they don't even show one ice age. They don't even show a complete ice age.
Yeah, so there's lots of problems with it then. There's lots of issues that...
Yeah,
they have to deal with that we can answer, I think.
Yes, the East Antarctic ice sheet, where they claim they can drill down to eight ice ages.
Yep.
And that's another story unto itself.
Well, Steve's telling me we are up on a break here, so why don't we take another break, and when we come back, what I'd like for you to talk about are the dating methods that they use or that everyone uses, basically, to come up with these ages, and will lead up to how these ice cores are used in terms of a dating method. But we'll take a break.
All right. Okay. If you just tuned in, listen, we're visiting with Ray Mondragon with the Creation Science Fellowship of New Mexico. As I mentioned, they meet the third Tuesday of each month at Faith Bible Church in Albuquerque, on Central at Moon. That's at 7 o'clock, the third Tuesday of each month. Details are on their website about past conversations they've had there and other things that are available through the Creation Science Fellowship of New Mexico, including membership So you may check that out, csfnm.org. We're going to take a quick break and come back with not only Ray Mondragon, but our guest via phone in Montana, Michael Ord. We'll get back to that after this on ABQ Connect.
On KLYT, this is ABQ Connect.
Now we'll continue our conversation with Ray Mondragon from the Creation Science Fellowship of New Mexico, csfnm.org. Find out about their monthly meeting third Tuesday of each month at Faith Bible Church in Albuquerque, Central, and Moon. His guest, Michael Ord, has been joining us, looking basically at some of the differences we see between what young Earth proponents would say, advocates for young Earth, as opposed to those that would date the Earth much older.
Billions.
In our last segment, we talked a little bit about ice cores, some of the work that Michael's done and has recorded in a few books. But one of his books, The Frozen Paradox, Ice Cores versus Deep Time, What Ice Cores Reveal About Earth's History. And Ray, as we move forward, we're going to look a little bit at some of the dating methods.
Yeah. In fact, if you can discuss very briefly the various ways that we have available to date things like the age of the Earth, and that'll lead us into how ice cores are used as a dating method. Can you comment on that?
Well, they date rocks and the age of the Earth by radiometric dating methods like uranium changing to lead over a certain amount of time. But ice cores and ice sheets are dated quite differently. They can't date ice by any of these radiometric methods, not even carbon-14. So they got to use more indirect methods based on their assumption of uniformitarianism. And this they do for ice sheets, and it's different for the Greenland and East Antarctic ice sheets. In Greenland, the way they, like I said, it only shows one ice age, and that to them is only about 120,000 years in their scheme. And so the evidence for millions of years are not there. But as far as the Greenland ice sheet, they believe they can count annual layers from the top now down to the bottom. And that's what these ice cores show, at the top, at least. Now, we know that there's nice annual layers and a lot of variables, winter and summer differences in these variables. So an annual layer at the top of the Greenland ice sheet's about 30 centimeters. Now, in southeast Greenland, where the Lost Squadron occurs, they get about 1.5 meters of pure ice a year. Total bullseye area that's not doesn't apply for the rest of the ice sheet. And it makes sense. It's close to the ocean and the Aleutian low that, excuse me, not the Aleutian low, but the Icelandic low, it's generally in that area. But anyway, the top is about 30 centimeters. And as you add layer after layer, it presses and thins out. But they're nice annual layers at the top. But because of the thinning and something called diffusion, the variables kind of mix up. And so you really can't date by annual layers very deep. One annual layer, they have several methods, but the main one they use for Greenland is cloudy and clear bands, which they will shine a laser beam through the ice core, ice, and they can pick these up. One problem they have is when they get to the ice age part, there's too many of these oscillations. So they don't know what the annual layer really is. So it goes back to their assumptions of uniformitarianism, of which they assume a certain thinning function as you go down based on the ice has been there for millions of years.
And so assumption upon assumption, right?
Yes, by the time you get to the bottom, they're the thin as a dime. And so they get all these wiggles in these variables going down there. And at first, when they got near the bottom, they only counted 85,000 of these layers. I'll talk briefly about those layers after I finish this. But it did not match the astronomical theory of the Ice Age, the Milankovitch theory, which drives all this post-flood dating, by the way, assuming these ice ages repeating at certain cycles. It didn't match, so they said you got to redate. So they redated the bottom 500 meters by a laser beam that had a resolution that used to have a little resolution of 8 millimeters, and it became 1 millimeter. And as a result, they found more wiggles. There's always wiggles at all scales. And guess what? They added 25,000 more wiggles, and which they say are annual layers at the bottom 500 meters, to get 110,000 years near the bottom, which matched the Milankovitch theory. And if this is in the literature, it's plain as day, and I document this in my books and in some of my research articles, which you can get on the creation.com website. So it's circular reasoning. They assume the astronomical theory is true. It's a 100,000-year cycle. Ice ages repeat every 100,000 years, and they count annual layers to match that. That's all there is to it for the Greenland ice sheet. But East Antarctica is different. It has not. It has some big wiggles. They claim there's eight of them, and that's 800,000 years. But you can't date the East Antarctic ice sheet by annual layers, because the top only gets to maybe about 5 centimeters of snow a year, and it blows all around, so you can't pick up any annual layers. So then how do you date the Antarctic ice sheet? You date it by matching similar oscillations in deep sea cores, which are dated by assuming the astronomical theory of the ice age. It's a vast circular reasoning network.
Yeah,
they have assumed the astronomical theory has been proved, which it hasn't, and then they use that to date not deep sea cores, and go to ice cores. That's all there is to it. It's circular reasoning is how they date these ice sheets.
Now, how would we interpret the same data from a young Earth viewpoint? How does the data fit the young Earth perspective?
Okay, we'd explain it quite different in that it wasn't in equilibrium for millions of years, of course. But it started at zero at the end of the flood and built up during the Ice Age, because the Ice Age consisted of warm ocean water, especially at mid and high latitudes, and volcanism that put these particles in the stratosphere. So you cooled the land, and the warm ocean caused huge evaporation at mid and high latitudes to catch cotton storms and dump on the land. And so most of it built up during the Ice Age, which is about 500 years to reach glacial maximum and about 200 years to melt. So it mostly built up during that time.
Now, we have a huge difference in terms of data, in that we believe that the Genesis flood had a lot to do with the Ice Age, the one Ice Age. So we start from Scripture and use the data that we have there to give us a framework, and that basically gives us lots of data that you're explaining here. So continue.
Yes, it's important to stick to Scripture. My theme verse for research is 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Examine everything carefully, hold fast to that which is good. Hold fast to the Bible, then I examine everything carefully. And so our annual layers, they would start out very thick at the bottom because of the warm ocean, rapid snow at the beginning, and tapering off through the Ice Age. So our annual layers would be meters thick. And so what they're picking up in our annual layers are storm layers. And even within a storm, things change. And so they can pick up layers that are formed within storms. So that's what they're picking up, the annual layers in Greenland. And based on the thick snow at the beginning, tapering off, and the warm ocean, I did some calculations of how can we explain all that forming most of it during the ice age. Well, that implies many meters a year of our annual thickness is near the bottom. I went to some of the snowiest areas in the world, the Cascade Mountains of Washington and Oregon, and Northwest Japan. Those areas get about 10 meters of water equivalent a year. So I use Mount Rainier as an analog. And based on Mount Rainier, which has the world's record snowfall, I might add, they get an average of about 3 meters of pure ice over the winter, which is about 4 months. But in Antarctica and Greenland, it'd be a perpetual winter with little seasonal contrast at the beginning. And so you'd have to multiply that 3 meters by, you'd have to at least double it. Say the winter season 6 months. If you doubled it for a winter all year round, that'd be, there you have 6 meters of ice just using Mount Rainier as an analog. But they get their moisture from the cool North Pacific. But if you had really warm water off there, the precipitation would be much greater. So say the evaporation was maybe five times as great as currently, Mount Rainier would have many, many meters of ice a year. And so Antarctica would be similar to this in that the warm water would add more than 6 meters a year. And so at the beginning, I calculated about 20 meters a year and decreasing to what we see today at the top. So we can account for the Greenland Antarctic ice sheet by the warmth of the ocean giving off huge evaporation. You can evaporate seven times as much water vapor into the air at a temperature of 30 degrees centigrade than you can at 0 degrees centigrade. Seven times.
Yeah.
If all the variables are the same.
So the bottom line,
all that added moisture.
The bottom line is the data better fits a relatively young Earth rather than fitting the billion-a-year scenario.
Yes, we
taking
can build
into account
up in short time.
Right, and I've explained to the audience your view on the Ice Age and how the Genesis Flood basically accounts for it. And if you take all of that into account, then that solidifies the idea of a relatively young Earth. Well, we're up against, Steve's telling me another break here, so we'll take a little break here.
Quickly preview, we'll have one more segment of about 12 minutes. Ray, let's tease a little bit about what we may be able to cover here before we get to the top of the hour.
He did kind of briefly mention this World War II squadron that gives a little bit of evidence and kind of throws a monkey wrench in the old Earth viewpoint.
Yes.
So you can discuss it. And I'd like for you to also to consider giving just a brief problem that carbon 14 dating does in terms of the old Earth.
So when we come back, a little bit of storytelling, but a true storytelling, and more discussion on carbon 14 dating and how important it is to, if you're going to use it right and get all those details when we come back with Ray Mondragon and Michael Lord after this on ABQ Connect.
You're listening to KLYT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect.
ABQ Connect, taking some time to visit once again with our friend Ray Mondragon, a regular on the broadcast from the Creation Science Fellowship of New Mexico. They meet the third Tuesday of each month at Moon and Central at Faith Bible Church, 7 p.m. It's free to attend, and you'll find details at csfnm.org. And Ray, you and I have talked about it several times. I mean, who should be coming out for these monthly meetings?
Well, we like to attract youth, public school students, and or homeschoolers. We get a lot of homeschoolers.
Are they not teaching this in public school, Ray?
You know the answer. And by the way, Michael Ord has spoken to our group. It's been a number of years, but he's come down to Albuquerque.
Very good.
Yes.
Have you been here often enough, Michael, to be able to answer the state question?
Red or green? What that is.
Yeah, red or green? Red or green?
Chili.
Oh. Yeah, okay.
I know things may not be that spicy in Montana, but the elk sure tastes good. Or the moose. I've had both.
I know. I shot one this February 8th.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you,
a mile from my house.
Living in Alaska for about 5 years as a kid, I will tell you, moose is about the best meat I think I've ever had.
Wow.
We had moose.
I agree.
We had moose everything. There's a story behind that. My uncle got out first time, with a guide and took a shot at a moose. And, you track them down. They don't always just fall. He came and. And there it is. Take another shot at it. And turns out he shot two moose and he killed them both. And he turned himself in, paid the fine, but they let him keep all of the meat. So our family was in the moose for quite some time, man. Moose burgers, spaghetti, meatloaf, everything. So, if you haven't had it, you have opportunity. Don't be stingy with the backstrap. All right.
I've shot three moose here in Montana.
Yeah, that'll keep you for quite some time. Listen, we digress. We'll have to get out and get a moose burger sometime. But let's get back to our conversation. We teased that we'd be talking about there's a story of a World War II squadron. We're also going to try to squeeze in a little more information on carbon dating,
and maybe even tree ring dating.
Yeah, and Michael had some other things that he hasn't really released yet he wanted to touch on. So
why don't you start off with the carbon 14 and then go from there?
Okay. I belong to a carbon 14, a global Zoom meeting among creation scientists. We haven't figured out all the details of that, but we generally believe that carbon 14 is pretty good, accurate up to 3,000 years in the past. It's beyond that the dates become exaggerated. And we think that since the carbon 14 myth, it only goes to about 50,000 years in their time scale. You can actually can go to 80,000, but contamination becomes a problem. But anyway, we believe that the 3,000 to 50,000 years can be telescoped between 3,000 and 4,500 years of our time from the flood, end of the flood at 4,500 years ago to 3,000 years. There are several possibilities to explain that, but we haven't come to a consensus. We're still discussing it and going through a lot of data. So that's about all I can say on that. But I want to say a little bit on tree rings. They calibrate tree rings by carbon 14. And so their dates for the first 3,000 years on tree rings is pretty good. But beyond that, it's exaggerated like carbon 14. And they date like the bristlecone pine out to 10,000 years. These have to be post-flood trees, by the way. And I think the oaks and the I think some pines in Northwest Europe are dated possibly a little older, 12 or 13,000. These would have to be post-flood, but the post-flood period is only 4,500 years. So how do we explain things like that? Well, there probably can be a lot of problems with their correlations, which I have not gone into. But one thing I can say that will add to this conversation, since I have dealt with the Ice Age, these trees had to grow during the Ice Age. And early in the Ice Age, because of the warm ocean, and that gave off a lot of heat. So your winters are going to be a lot warmer early in the Ice Age, and your summers cooler on land, at least, because of the volcanic particles in the stratosphere that reflect some of the sunlight back to space. So what I'm saying is there's very little seasonal contrast in temperature to make tree rings. But tree rings can be made by differences in moisture. also with this, with the warm ocean temperatures, you have much more evaporation and much more precipitation. Even in areas that did not produce ice, you had heavy rain.
Now, the warm ocean is due to some of the phenomenon of the Genesis flood, right?
Yes, especially volcanism. And we start off with a warm pre-flood ocean because the pre-flood climate was a lot warmer, mainly because of water vapor, more water vapor that we know was there based on the amount of coal being 10 times the amount of carbon in it as today's biosphere. Coal is pre-flood plant material buried. And the upshot about having 10 times as many trees and plants is they give off water vapor in their leaves called transpiration. So you'd have much more water vapor. Water vapor, 75% of the greenhouse effect. Presto, you got a warm pre-flood climate and a warm pre-flood ocean. Add all that volcanism, huge volcanism during the flood, you'd end up with a very warm ocean after the flood. And that's the key to one of the keys to the ice age. And it would cause warm winters and cool summers, little seasonal contrast with heavy precipitation. So it is very possible that you had multiple rings formed by multiple precip events. Say you had cycles of 1 month cycles
within the same year, multiple tree rings within the same year. Yeah.
Yes. Due not to differences in temperature, but differences in precipitation. Say you had precipitation oscillate every month. It's possible that you get a time of precip and a warm winters, you have rapid growth. And then suddenly you have a little dry period, stop the growth. And you can have multiple rings in these trees each year as a result. And now I have not published this yet. I've been thinking about it for many years, but I work on so many projects that I haven't got to it yet. But that's how I believe we can explain the supposed trees that are up to 12,000 years old, they claim, is mostly by multiple rings per year.
So no uniformitarianism again.
No. See, this is the point when we bring the flood and the post-flood ice age back into Earth history, we can solve challenges that they give us.
Yep.
And I'd be able to do it. There are several hundred challenges. I've worked on some of the majors, and I mainly mentioned ice cores in this broadcast, but I've touched on carbon-14 and tree rings I'll do in the future. So, yes, it's important. Ice age is very, very key, and the details of it are very important to account for a lot of phenomena. I'm working on a book on the origin of caves, and I believe caves can be formed early in the ice age because of heavy precipitation, mild winters, more ventilation due to storminess. So you can form speleothems rapidly, maybe 100 times faster than today's rate, which is what they assume for the past. So
great.
We can solve a lot of things this way by bringing the flood and the ice age into biblical Earth history.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple of minutes that we have here, can you discuss that squadron that was found in Greenland under the ice?
Oh, yes.
World War II squadron?
That has a message to tell us, but it's possible we can misinterpret it. So what the story is that I think in 1942, these planes got caught in a blizzard and had to land in the southeast edge of the Greenland ice sheet. And so I think there were eight planes. And they landed safely and were rescued. And so about 40 years later, someone got the idea, well, I think they destroyed most World War II airplanes, if I'm not mistaken. So they decided, we want to get one of these and put it together and fly it. And they went out there and they could not find it. And they got, later on, got a more sensitive probe. And they found the planes buried under about 70 meters of ice, 3 miles from where they landed. And that greatly surprised them. I happened to and what they did was they burrowed down, made a core, maybe a melted core, about maybe 2 meters wide down there, and they got down to one of the planes, and they broke it up into pieces and brought it up in pieces, and were putting it together in Middlesboro, Kentucky. And I happened to just drive through there when they were finishing the job in stock.
Wow.
And I asked the guy doing it, who was responsible, the foreman probably, how deep did he think the ice was when they first went out there? He told me about 15 feet. So anyway, they got it up. It's called Glacier Girl, and they fly it. So what's the story it tells us? Well, it's Southeast Greenland Ice Sheet. The precipitation rate is about 1.5 meters of pure ice each year. That's much different than the rest of the Greenland Ice Sheet. At the top, you only get about 30 centimeters of pure ice. So you can use it to say that when the Greenland Ice Sheet wasn't there, everything was low altitude and warm water around, you could get meters of precipitation a year. That's what it tells you when there's no ice there. But it won't tell you about what you should get now on the top, because the top is a lot higher and drier and away from the Icelandic low. There's a permanent low pressure center west of Iceland in that area, and it's close to the ocean. So meteorologically, it makes sense that you'd have a bullseye pattern of heavy precipitation there. And so it gives us what we can say, how fast the precipitation can build up when there isn't an ice sheet there, and you have water. In fact, the water for the Icelandic low is cool. But if you have really warm water, you can see how you get many, many meters of pure ice a year early in the ice age, when things were the winters were still mild. But as time went on, the ice age was very dynamic. By the end of it, it became very cold winters and summers warmer.
So another
very dry.
Another example of no uniformitarianism.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm gotta stick with the Bible.
I'm sensing a theme here, and actually, the latest theme is we are out of time. But I do want to thank Ray Mondragon of the Creation Science Fellowship of New Mexico and Michael Ord for being our guest. Michael's the author of The Frozen Paradox: Ice Cores versus Deep Time, What Ice Cores Reveal About Earth's History, and Ray Mondragon, Science is God Shouting. That's his latest book, The Biblical Foundation for Science. Details about that at truegracebooks.com. And, of course, we mentioned Ray's personal website, where you can find these conversations and much more information at forhisglorynm.com. Ray, Michael, thanks so much for your time. Look forward to having you again.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. And thank you for listening to ABQ Connect.
ABQ Connect is a production of KLYT. The views expressed on ABQ Connect do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KLYT.